Good morning. My name is Tana Hartman. I'm with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and welcome to the Wilf Show. Our guest today is Shai Tamari. Shai was born and raised in Jerusalem. He's specializing in the history and politics of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He served in the Israeli army between 1994 and 97. He earned a bachelor's degree in journalism from Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, and a master's in Near and Middle Eastern Studies from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He is currently a Rotary World Peace Fellow at UNC. He's completing a master's in history, and along with a certificate in Arabic and conflict resolution. He will be speaking this weekend, and right now I'm going to have him start off by telling us a little bit about the historical roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. 2 days ago, on May 14th, Israel celebrated 60 years of independence. But the Israeli-Palestinian conflict dates from long before 1948. Shai, tell us a little bit about the historical roots of the conflict.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me, first of all. It's a pleasure being here. I've been studying this conflict for the past 7 years, and the more I study it, the more questions I have. So the chance of people understanding it better after half an hour is probably very limited. But I hope that at the end of this, people will have a better understanding and at least know what questions to ask in the future. People assume that the conflict has been going on since biblical times, and that is actually incorrect. It's only been going on since the early 1880s, to be more precise, since 1882. We want to start from that date. Prior to 1882, you had about 24,000 Jews living in what was then Palestine. And it was very peaceful because the Jews living there were mostly religious Jews. They were not nationalistic. And the Arabs and the Jews got along very well. In the early 1880s, the ideology of Zionism began in Eastern Europe and Russia. And Zionism is basically Jewish nationalism. And the first, there were about five waves of immigration prior to 1948 into what was then Palestine. And the first wave began in 1882, and they were mostly Russian Jews who were socialists, who came to Palestine, who bought land and somehow managed to work together with the Arabs. So they bought land, but they actually were hiring the Arabs to work on the land. And so although there was a tension, it was still manageable. 1903 began a second wave of immigrants from Eastern Europe. And these Jews, who actually suffered from pogroms, anti-Semitism, more than the first wave, came to Palestine and decided that from now on, they're only going to be living a Jewish life along with Jewish people and not actually cooperate with the Arabs living in Palestine. And that's really when it became more violent between the two sides, because there was a great sense of nationalistic ideology happening with the new Jewish immigrants and not willing to work with the Arabs at the time.
Well, let me ask you a quick question there. How much did I've heard about the Iron Wall and this philosophy.
Theory.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that and how much that had to do, because it wasn't originally that was that if the Jews showed armed strength, that it then would deter aggressions.
The person who came up with this theory is Zev Jabotinsky, and it basically started in the 1920s, and his belief was that at the time there was no real chance of reaching a peaceful solution with the Arabs living in Palestine, and therefore he believed that the only way to move forward is to create quote-unquote an iron wall, to have a strong military presence there, and once the Arabs understand that they can't actually win or beat the Jews, then it'll be time to negotiate with the Arabs of Palestine. Ironically, if you read Avi Schleim's book, The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World, he talks about this theory, and he basically explains that Zev Jabotinsky actually believed that there would be a chance to settle things with the Arabs, but every single government in Israel and every single leader has practiced the Iron Wall but neglecting the last part, which is the negotiation with the Palestinians. So that's where it actually stems from.
What about the... What are the most promising initiatives? I mean, there have been a number of attempts. We've seen Camp David. We've seen the Oslo Accords. But, I mean, the violence keeps re-erupting, or at least it seems so. I mean, 1920 and 21 saw the Palestinian riots, 29 the Hebron Massacre, 36, 39 the Arab Revolt, and 48 the Arab-Israeli War. And it just, you know, I was looking over this history briefly. But we also have, within there, we have the 1978 Camp David Accords, and then we have the 1993 Oslo Accords. There was also something we don't hear much about, and that was the Arab Peace Initiative, Beirut in 2002, I
right,
think.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about those, and why they haven't worked.
Okay. Well, the initiative actually started with Saudi Arabia, who suggested that if Israel withdrew from the territories it occupied in 1967 and found a solution for the refugees, that all the Arab countries would then recognize Israel. Personally, I found it to be an amazing offer, and they reiterated this offer in 2007. Israel has never actually said no to it, but it never said yes either. And the reason is, it's because Israel finds it very hard to simply leave the West Bank. And the idea of settling or finding a solution for the Palestinian refugees is also an issue, because the fear is that you don't want them to coming back to Israel, what is today Israel. Israel fears that by having Palestinian refugees return to Israel, it would shake the Jewish identity of the state. And so Israel is having a lot of issues finding ways to leave the West Bank and receive this recognition from the Arab countries. Ironically, what Israel has always said that it really wants to be recognized by the Arab countries. And so here you have this very good offer from the Arab countries, and Israel still hasn't moved towards it. The last I heard was Ehud Olmert saying, you know, it's a very positive solution, but nothing has actually moved ahead with it. Why that is exactly, I'm not quite sure, but I think it is simply the fear of leaving the West Bank, because the argument is that if you leave the West Bank, we'll be more vulnerable to Palestinian attack. Ironically, Israel does have a security issue in the West Bank, but it's a security issue that it created itself. People forget that at the end of the day, it was Israel who took over the West Bank and Gaza. And it took over the West Bank and Gaza not because it wanted to control the Palestinians, but it wanted to force the hands of Jordan and Egypt to make peace with it. Because at the time, Jordan was in control of the West Bank and Egypt of Gaza. And so Israel, at the time, took over those pieces of land in a way to force them to make peace, but it kind of backfired, because that although there was peace now between Egypt and Jordan and Israel, Israel got stuck with the West Bank and Gaza, even though now it's no longer inside Gaza, but it still controls the area.
You have, forgive me, it's not really ageist, I hope, but you're very young. I mean, yet you have a lot of experience. I mean, you have a good bit of experience with it. You as an Israeli soldier, tell us a little bit about that experience and how that affected you.
Well, I was actually raised fairly right-wing. I was, at the age of 13, for a short period of time, I was a member of an extreme right-wing group in Israel. And so that had an effect on me. But as I grew older, I started questioning things. And the army experience, I'm not sure if it had much to do with the way I see things today, but it definitely had an impact. When I first joined the army in 94, I became a paratrooper for my first 6 months, but I injured my leg in my first parachute jump, and I became a shooting instructor afterwards. So I didn't actually meet face-to-face Palestinians who were hostile towards me. I was mostly in behind the lines, and I think at the time I was very disappointed that I wasn't in the front line, because you know Israel is a fairly militaristic country, and so people look highly on you if you are you know in combat or in a situation where you have to deal with Palestinians in that way. Looking back now, I'm quite grateful that I didn't actually have to you know, stand in checkpoints on a regular basis or deal with hostile Palestinians. And the reason is that today I have so many Palestinian friends, it'll be really difficult for me to look them straight in the eye and feel comfortable. And I know that what I did in the past, although I taught people or soldiers basically how to kill by using a weapon, I wasn't part of that that myself, and so I'm quite grateful for that these days.
Were someplace at a checkpoint, and a Palestinian, you were told to let all the cars through.
Yes.
But tell that story.
Well, it wasn't really a checkpoint. It was my second week in the army. Our unit was, we were based in the West Bank, and we were taken out of the base, and we were just sitting on the side of the road. And it wasn't a real checkpoint to begin with. You could see from a distance a Palestinian car coming, and you could see it's Palestinian because they have a different license plate on the cars. They have different colors. And one of the soldiers walked to the center of the road and lifted his weapon and aimed it at the driver, not telling him to stop, just lifting the weapon and aiming it. And the driver slammed on his brakes, and the soldier just kept his weapon aimed at the person's face. And then he lowered it, and you know, he signaled to the driver to pass on through. And then he came back to sit with us and had a grin on his face. And that really bothered me, because until that moment, I actually was very naive and didn't think that Israeli soldiers did that. And it was at that moment that I realized that we do. And so that had a great impact on me. To balance the story, however, about 2 weeks after that, my unit, whenever you go back for a weekend home, you usually come back and you meet in a certain place to be picked up by a bus, and then you go to your base. And usually it's every week you would meet at the same place. That particular week, my unit met elsewhere, but my sister unit went to the same place, and there were two bombs waiting for them there, which exploded and killed dozens of people. And it's a place that I was supposed to be in myself. And the following day, me and my comrades, we went to their funerals and as honorary guards. And I just remember seeing the parents and grandparents of those who died just crying their eyes out and lying on their graves. And I was just so grateful it wasn't me. It was a very selfish feeling at the time. But I just remembering my grandparents and my parents, and I wouldn't have wanted them to be in that situation.
Well, understandable as a mother.
Yeah.
I understand that. But these experiences, when you were a soldier, were not unique to you. Others must have had them too, and yet you have taken a totally different path. Why is that?
Once I finished my army service, I actually went to London. I also have a British passport, and I was traveling there and working there and basically searching for myself and didn't find myself. And the irony with London is very much more pro-Arab and much more anti-Israel. And when I was living there, I actually became more pro-Israel in the sense of more right-wing. I'm still pro-Israel, I just have a different angle to it. But it's when I got to Australia, and Australia is just so far away from the conflict, from the region, and people would just ask me questions, not actually push me to either direction. It's also when the Second Intifada, the Second Palestinian Uprising, began in 2000, and it's then when I really started questioning things, that everything that I was raised on didn't make any sense. One of my favorite quotes is by Judge Judy, which basically she says, if it doesn't make any sense, it's probably not true. And so many things weren't making sense to me at the time. And I started my bachelor's degree in journalism at the time. And the majority of articles I was writing was about the conflict. And I was talking to people, I was researching. For the first time, I was reading books by Palestinians and articles by Palestinians, and really getting, suddenly understanding there was another side to the conflict, a side that I was completely unaware of. And of course that shook a lot of, inside of me, my identity was totally transferred, and still it is. I'm still trying to find out where I stand internally. But I think being in Australia at the beginning of this journey of mine, and really searching for myself for the first time, not being told what to think, but really being open up to everything. That had a great impact on me.
And where do you want to go from here?
Complete my journey here, after finishing my bachelor's degree in Australia, I went to London and did a master's in Middle Eastern studies. And that also had a huge impact on me because I was studying with many Arabs. For the first time, I was in class with people from Palestine, from Lebanon, from Egypt, from Iraq, etc. And for the first time, I actually was mingling with them, not just in school, but outside. And so when I finished that degree and came here to UNC, where I completed now my 2 years degree in history, my sense is that I want to be part of some sort of solution to the conflict. And it sounds really idealistic and very optimistic, but I still feel that I do want to be part of it in a political manner. And so now I'm looking for work in DC with any organization, whether it's a think tank, a lobby group, or even in government that is dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I find that the road to a political solution in the Middle East, like it or not, runs through Washington, D.C. And so if you want to be part of that, you need to be in D.C., basically.
Okay. Why is that? Why do you think it runs through D.C.?
Because the U.S. has such a huge impact on the conflict, negative and positive. Currently more negative, but I believe it can be more positive if people start looking at it from a different angle. And I believe because I do understand both sides, and I'm talking about both sides within Israel, both the right wing and the left wing, and because I spent last summer in Jordan and I was with Palestinians there, I can really grasp better the whole conflict. Although I still have a lot to learn, but I believe that I have a lot to offer for people in DC who have power and control over decisions that affect the area. And so that's really where I want to be, at least for the next year or two. And so I'm hopeful that something will come about in the next few weeks.
Well, it's encouraging that you have this optimism because there seems to be so much despair around it, and so there's such great antipathies. These antipathies, are they cultural, ethnic, as well as political, or is it primarily political? You think that the solution is primarily political, right?
Yes, I do. But first, I like the definition of hope is the belief that something is possible, even though you don't have the facts to back it up. So I'm very hopeful. But on the other hand, people who claim that there's no solution for the conflict are people who look at it from a very particular angle, and the same angle that I was looking at it from. Me personally was from the angle of Zionism. And if you look at it from that ideology, there is no solution that can please both sides. You can only please one side. In this case, it's the Jewish side. For Palestinians, many, they see it from their own angle, and they see it, well, it can be either them or us. But I'm at a point now when I can actually see both sides working together and finding a solution. And it sounds, again, very optimistic. But there is the other solution is just war. And we've been doing this for over 60 years. And so far, it hasn't worked. So I'm pushing for a change in thought, in the sense that instead of competing with one another, I find that cooperation actually works better. And maybe this is where my mediation course comes into effect here, which I took at UNC. I do believe that collaboration with one another is actually much more beneficial to both sides rather than competing. Because when you compete, at the end of the day, you might get something, but you also be losing something else. The irony is that both Israelis and Palestinians have one thing that's very much in common to both of them, and that they both love the same land at the end of the day. And land has become part of people's identity. And this is the reason why people find it hard to let go of land in the Middle East, because people feel the more land you have, the stronger your identity is, basically. But what I find is that you don't really have to give up the land if you just want to share it. And so this is where my hope is, that eventually people will see that. It might not happen in my lifetime, but I definitely want to be part of that mechanism that will bring people to that belief that at the end of the day, both sides have to rely on each other to find prosperity and happiness. And by taking it from the other, they're actually taking it from themselves too.
That's, I think there are some great insights there, and I certainly hope that you find a group to work with that actually, I mean, have you identified any? Anyone working this?
Okay. Well, I was up in D.C. 2 weeks ago, and I found two things. One encouraging, one less encouraging. The encouraging was that there are not many people such as myself with my perspective looking for work, and it's encouraging because it means there's more opportunities for me. The bad thing is there are not many actual positions available either. So it's a blessing and a curse at the same time. But I wanted to mention this. 2 weeks ago when I was up in D.C., I actually gave a briefing on Hamas at the Pentagon, at the Middle East Division. And I had my own stereotype of the Pentagon. I had, you know, neoconservative, right-wing, no clue what's going on in the region, only looking at American interests. And I was completely surprised because there was a difference between the professional people and the political appointees. And political appointees are the ones who basically follow what administration wants them to follow, which so far has been fairly neoconservative. The professionals who are basically paid there to work and are part of the intelligence community and the army, I found them to be extremely realistic, very down to earth, very much understanding what needs to be done. And I was just shocked to hear that they actually believed that the U.S. should be talking to Hamas and to Iran and to Hezbollah, and it was like, wow, I didn't see that coming. And so I had, you know, I actually was completely wrong about some aspects of the Pentagon. And so it was, for me, an eye-opener. And that's, I guess, again, part of what gives me hope, in the sense that, you know, you and I probably think of that part of the U.S. or the government as being unrealistic. But what I found was that people are very knowledgeable and very understanding of the conflict. And these are people who don't view the conflict from their desk in Washington, but people who actually go to the region and talk to people on a regular basis and are much more aware of what's going on. And in fact, one of the people that I met there, he and I are going to be working on an article together, writing about the need of the U.S. to talk to Hamas. And so it'll be an interesting collaboration between a Rotary World Peace Fellow and somebody from the Pentagon. And so hopefully it'll cause some waves.
That's exciting, actually. Hamas. Tell us a little bit right now about where things stand with Hamas.
Most recently, Hamas has been working with Egypt to find a way to have a hudna. A hudna, it's an Arabic word, basically means a ceasefire on both sides. It's not a peace deal, it's just a cessation of hostilities for a certain period of time. And Egypt has been a very important part of negotiations between Israel and Hamas. And it actually managed to get all the Palestinian factions within Gaza to agree to some sort of stop of the violence from their side, if Israel agreed to that too. Israel, unfortunately, has said no. And the reason Israel argues that it doesn't actually want to have a ceasefire with Hamas is because it claims that once there is a break in the violence, Hamas will use that as a way to gain more weapons, to train more, and to get ready to for the next battle. Personally, I think that Hamas hasn't had much problem doing that while still fighting with Israel. And it's not that I am a Hamas supporter, but I do believe that there is, people don't give it enough credit, in the sense that since 1994, it has been offering Israel this hudna. And since 1994, Israel has been saying no. And so instead, Hamas has been practicing a tahadiyah. Tahadiyah means a calming. It's a one-sided calming. And so there were periods of time when Hamas basically stopped its own attacks against Israel, but Israel continued its own attacks against Hamas, believing that Hamas will eventually be attacking anyway, so why not do it now? people don't really know that between 2001 and until February of this year, Hamas didn't actually conduct any suicide attacks in Israel, and just started again after what happened in Gaza, and the blockade that happened in Gaza. And so what I find ironic is that both the U.S. and Israel refuse to talk to Hamas, when in fact Hamas is such an integral part of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And Israel and the U.S. seem to want to speak to Fatah, who is the other party within the Palestinian society, believing that once they reach a deal with Fatah, for some reason it will last, and it won't, because a large majority of Palestinians support Hamas. As you saw in the elections.
Yes.
And that's part of the irony, is that both Israel and the U.S., or mostly the U.S., was pushing for elections in Palestinian society, and they finally did it. And once the announcement came out, both Israel and the U.S. and also the European Union backed away. And so that is the sad part of the story, because it was, other than Israel, that was probably the most democratic elections that ever happened in the Middle East. And yet it was not recognized by the international community, which, what do you think, how do you think Palestinians then view the whole idea of democracy then? You know, and so when the U.S. is pushing for democracy but not actually following through when they do have it, that's a problem. The irony is that once you have democratic elections in the Middle East, most countries don't then follow the U.S. way of life, and actually, or not, at least not politically. And so in many ways, until now, the U.S. had its own interest in supporting countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, who don't have democracy, because they know they'll be close to the U.S. this way. But I do believe that democracy should be encouraged in the Middle East, especially in Palestinian society. This is important for me to say this. What the U.S. and Israel practices is a competitive democracy, which means that it is whoever wins basically gets to rule. And that works well in a society that's not divided. Palestinian society is very much divided into at least two groups, which means that in order for them to work out in a democratic way, they have to practice a cooperative democracy, basically meaning that instead of having one party rule over everybody else, the parties that are the main parties in the society should be ruling together. And so the U.S. and Israel should be encouraging both Fatah and Hamas to work together rather than work apart, because in their society, competitive democracy does not work. And they need to understand that. And so the only way it's going to work is if they are encouraged to work together. And Palestinian society has always been divided since at least the 1920s. And so they don't need any help from other from outsiders to be divided. What they need help is from outsiders to work together. And there have been many initiatives recently, the last one being in Yemen, to find a way for the Fatah and Hamas to work together. Unfortunately, both Israel and the U.S. have been discouraging Fatah from working with Hamas, saying, you talk to them, you don't talk to us. And so that is a main problem. And I'm hoping that eventually Washington, D.C. will see that the error in that and start working towards finding a way to have both parts of society work together.
I hope you're right. You are going to be speaking this weekend, and you're actually going to have another radio interview later today. But tell us about the event this weekend. It is Israel at 60, Facing Challenges, Sustaining Democracy, and it's going to be at the Judea Reform Congregation, 1933 West Cornwallis Road in Durham. It's free and open to the public.
Yes,
right?
I'll be screening a movie called Bridge Over the Wadi, which ironically was actually on PBS this last Sunday. But the movie looks at a school within Israel that has 50% Jews and 50% Arabs, and looks at how the students and the teachers and the parents all work together, and the stress and the anxiety that they both face. But it's a very powerful movie, and it really explains or shows how Israel should be moving towards having education together with Arabs and Jews.
Well, I hope everyone will turn out for it. If you want more information, go to chapter at btvshalom, btvshalom.org. And again, that's Saturday at 7:30 at the Judea Reform Congregation in Durham on West Cornwallis Road. thank you for joining us. This has been the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and you are listening to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Please join us again next week when we'll have Steve Deere talking about the death penalty.